Well, thanks, Mark. It's a real pleasure for me to be here, although you call me friend and then you give me the topic that I've been given today. I love going to BIF meetings, and one of the reasons I keep coming back is because I've had the opportunity to make so many friends here. As I thought about this talk, in some ways this may be the perfect BIF talk. I know Kent Anderson raised expectations with his 3 months of preparation. Rest assured, those of you that know me, particularly my graduate students, know that's not the case with this one. But I will say that the friends I've made make it really fun. And as I thought about this being a perfect BIF talk, I think it's perfect because throughout the talk, I think by the time I've done, I'll have had the opportunity to offend almost everyone in the room. And so that got me thinking, I wonder what BIF will be like next year when I don't have as many friends in the room. Mark mentioned that we were sort of, there was a friendly rivalry between Georgia and Colorado State. He didn't tell you that when I visited Colorado State to consider graduate school, he was my guide and showed me around, and you can tell what a great job he did. You know, this section is called Challenges to Conventional Wisdom, and so having selected some wisdom-challenged folks to take that topic on, I'll dive right into my topic. And, you know, the question that's been raised, I think, so one of the persons and another friend that someone that's sort of run this up the flagpole and done an awfully good job was Troy Marshall a few years ago in Seedstock Digest, talking about the idea that there is a perception, a conventional wisdom, if you will, that we are just doing a bang-up job in terms of changing our carcass genetics and meeting consumer expectations, and yet any measure of carcass performance that you see out in the industry doesn't really reflect that. And there are lots of ideas about why that might be, but I credit Troy with the idea of bringing it up. The other credit that I'd like to make is to Dr. Ronnie Green. Some of you were in Birmingham over a decade ago and heard an eloquently titled presentation called Carcass EPDs, Put Up or Shut Up. Okay, what a great title, and made it very memorable for me. But if you want to look back at the history and sort of see where we've come in terms of carcass traits, if you have this old proceedings, dig it out and read that article. Unfortunately, it's not online yet, although maybe it should be. But it really gives an excellent snapshot of where we were at that time. Questions that were being asked were things like, is ultrasound useful? Will genomics help in carcass quality? Do we need carcass EPDs across the board? And I think in a lot of ways we've answered that in some ways, but I'd really like to get your perspective. And so we'll start with an audience response today. From your perspective, since that time, how did we respond to Dr. Green's challenge as an industry? Did we put up? Did we shut up? Did we give up? Or did we do something else? What's your perspective on the industry's effort overall in terms of genetic improvement of eating quality and carcass traits? And yes, I did specifically ask for that song. It looks like you guys feel pretty good, that for the most part, the perception was that we did put up. And I think for the most part, we did. This is one of those great trick questions that college professors tend to ask where there really is no right answer. But those are the ones that I really love to ask because it's really interesting to see what students or what the industry will respond to those sort of questions. I think that maybe in all of the above might be an answer because I think in some ways we did put up in some ways. Probably shut up isn't a good response. This is the seedstock industry after all, and shut up is probably the last thing that we're very good about doing. We're pretty quick to tout our accomplishments and that sort of thing, and that's just the nature of the business we're in, so I could have a little fun with that. But in terms of what our putting up really got us, we're not seeing dramatic changes in the quality or the cutability, and it depends on how you define dramatic. Okay, I went to the USDA data and looked at the last decade, basically the time since Dr. Green's presentation, and looked at the trends in terms of percentage carcasses that are grading prime and choice under USDA inspection and grading, and also what's happening in terms of yield grade 1 and 2. And the graphs sort of tell a story. There is actually some improvement in quality grade that's happening. It depends on how you define significant in terms of the trend. And I think this is something important enough to maybe look at the real numbers and go through that a little bit. But as we go from, and there are, of course, a lot of factors involved. Some of them are genetic. Some of them are certainly environmental. And Pete Anderson, I think, will do a great job in a little bit of talking about some of those and putting those together and framing those for you. But compared to where we were a decade ago, we have improved prime and choice a little bit. But if you studied the trend on yield grade 1s and 2s, that one has certainly gone in the other direction. And there are a variety of reasons why. And I guess the one that caught my attention the most is the trend on yield grade 4s. I didn't have that on the line, but if you go to the last year's data at USDA, 9.1 yield grade 4s. I asked Tom Field about that this morning and asked for his perception of why that's happening. And he thinks that camera grading or instrument is a significant part of that. And I think that probably is. But I think what that is doing is revealing what's always been there. I think it's always been there. And our customers, our commercial customers, or whoever ends up reaping the end value of that product, that's going to be reflected in their pricing. And it's going to be reflected in their profitability. So there is certainly, I don't know if that is really a true trend in the cattle that we have or just a trend in the way that the value is starting to be discovered. But I think that is a challenge somewhat to all sectors of our industry to think about the balance of carcass quality with cutability. So my first shot at conventional wisdom, or at least my perception of what conventional wisdom is that what we said before. We've made great genetic progress in beef quality, and of course human nature is to point the other way, to point a finger at someone else and say, we're getting our part done and somebody else is screwing it up. And so I think that there's somewhat a perception of that. So let's investigate a little bit what's happening in that particular area. I went to websites of the various breed associations. I love the internet. I love sire summaries on the internet and all the powerful tools that it provides. But the thing I miss in the book, remember the book? Remember when sire summaries were in paper? Remember the front of the book? Maybe you guys flipped right by that. But that's just the kind of the math geek that I am, is I actually read that part. Ken Anderson's glad that somebody actually did. He wrote it just for me, I guess. But there were some neat things in there, and there still are, and I still like to pull them out and show them to my students, and they're still there. You just have to do a couple more clicks over on the side to find out a lot about what's happening in your breed. But there's some good information there that I challenge you to dig in and find. And some of those things are what's happening, what are the genetic trends in your particular breed. Sometimes they're in numbers, sometimes they're in graphs, but they're there. And as I looked through, first off, not all breeds provide genetic trends on carcass traits, and I'd like to see more of them provide that. But as I viewed it, it seemed to me that, for the most part, the consensus is more ribeye is better. You know, that's a really kind of a sexy trait in these days, to have more ribeye. Everybody feels good about more ribeye, and everybody's kind of moving in that direction. Some of that is growth-driven. Some of that is maybe even visual selection on muscling in some segments of the seed stock industry. Some of that is driven by ultrasound as well. But there's definitely a trend across all breeds to increase ribeye compared to where it was 10 or 20 years ago. Marbling is really breed dependent. It seems that the Black Angus breed is doing a more dramatic increase in marbling than other breeds. Some of the other breeds are moving in that direction as well. Some breeds have awfully flat trends for their measure of marbling or IMF. Some have really made no change in that at all, and we'll talk about some of the reasons why that might be. I didn't see anyone that was reducing fat. No one. That for the most part, they're flat. One breed shows a slight uptick in fat. And that concerns me a little bit. I think sometimes we have this conventional wisdom or perception that I'll manage fat. Fat is a manageable thing. I'll select on ribeye, I'll select on marbling, and I'll let the cattle feeder manage fat, and that'll solve all my problems. Because look at the swine industry. That's what they did, right? You know, that's how they got those hogs to be so lean. They just managed fat. No, it's a highly heritable trait. And yes, you can manage one thing, but there is an interaction between those traits that if you say, I'm going to manage for less fat, you're going to get less or more of other things as well. There is an opportunity to select for leanness, and it's not necessarily the disaster that sometimes we all perceive it to be. And so, again, a challenge I would make is that maybe that fat EPD that we sometimes don't even bother to print in the sale catalog might be a tool that we just need to get out of the toolbox once in a while. How much change are we really making for marbling? You know, you can make those lines look as steep as you want by playing with PowerPoint and changing the scale, and college professors are better than that than anybody, except maybe breed association folks. But you can move that around a little bit. Well, there's one off my list. But the trend for the last 10 to 15 years in the American Angus Association database is about 0.015 units of marbling EPD per year. One of the things I think that challenges a little bit in marbling is we all know what a pound of birth weight is, right? We can perceive a tenth of an inch of fat, but a marbling score is this sort of magic thing that nobody really knows, but they just know more is better. But if I showed you two ribeye steaks and there was that much difference in marbling, no, you could take it times 10 and you still probably wouldn't pick out the difference. Okay, so there is some change, but how much does that really mean? That one whole unit is the difference between minimum select and minimum choice, or minimum choice and minimum premium choice. So if we were moving the average of the population, say from the middle of select to the middle of low choice, at that particular rate, we'd do it in about 60 years, okay? Just in time for the centennial of BIF. Wouldn't that be exciting? Okay? And in the other breeds, it'll take twice as long, okay? You know, what's a sesquicentennial, Tom? Is that what 150 is? Okay. So get that on your calendar. We'll have a marbling celebration there. So my sort of review is that while the conventional wisdom said we've got this nailed, that upon further review, I like that phrase, you know, because I like college football and pro football and all that sort of thing. Upon further review, I think in many cases we have overstated how much change we're really making. The next time you hear about this runaway roller coaster of marbling selection that we're on and what a disaster that's going to be, go back to that page on the website and really see. Now, that's not to underestimate the changes that individual breeders are making. Okay, those are breed-wide trends, and there is a section of the industry, and some of them are in this room, that have made remarkable change. These are breed averages, but there is also a segment of every breed that is, for the large part, ignoring this for a number of reasons. So I know I've learned from 10 or 12 years of college teaching that nothing gets people on the end of their seat, on the edge of their seat, like an algebraic equation. And so to kind of bring you back to the discussion, I've put this up, and so I can see your appetite just being wet by this. But really, as seed stock breeders and even commercial breeders, you ought to be excited about this, because this is what it's all about. This is what it's all about. This is what you do. These are the things that get you going. This is what makes you successful or not successful. So I want to talk just a little bit about the individual tools that drive genetic change. And so Rick Borden put this equation in his textbook, and I try to break it down to students, and I'll try to do it as well. But really the things that go in there, and these are nothing new, that Jay Lush had this figured out some time ago, accuracy of selection, generation interval, amount of variation in the population, and the intensity of selection. Okay. Those, you maybe don't call them those things, but those are things that you are doing. And a lot of the things that you spend money on are things to try to overcome some antagonisms in these sort of things. Dr. Lush, there were some textbooks laying around in the history room, and if you haven't been in there, that's a neat place to go. And I appreciate the folks that put that together. That's a neat exhibition of our past and made us really think about our future. But I was fortunate enough to be gifted an original copy of Animal Breeding Plans a few years ago. And I love a quote that's in there from Dr. Lush in his textbook. And he says, variation basically is the raw material on which the breeder works. So many times in the industry we hear about variation and we test variation. We talk about how it's a problem and how pork and poultry are so much better in minimizing variation. But yet if they're all the same, does it really matter which one you use? No. We have to have some variation in the population to make change. If none are better than the others, then it really doesn't matter whether you buy the $5 straw semen or the $50 straw semen if it's all the same. So we need variation, and we're maintaining variation, and there are efforts to maintain variation. But as an individual breeder, this is the one you probably do the least about. You can do the least about. You know, an example of variation being limited is why I look at the Holstein breed. That they have done such a fabulous job of selecting in a single direction for a common trait across the world, they have very little variation left, it seems to me. And so they are limited in how much additional change they can make if they want to make more change in milk production. Can a seed stock producer increase genetic variation, or can a breed increase variation? Going from purebreds to hybrids is an opportunity to add new genetics into a pool, and so that is an opportunity to add genetic variation. Some of the breeds are aggressively looking at international evaluation and importation of germplasm, semen or embryos or that sort of thing, because there may be, perhaps, in some breeds, there are populations that are unrelated that may have some very valuable genes to be imported and to make our population better. And really, for a commercial producer, to maintain a successful crossbreeding program, there probably are needs for more than one breed to have some really high-quality marbling lines. That could probably be developed in some other places. That would help a commercial industry maintain variation, maintain heterosis, and those sort of things, if they had some options in some of those other breeds, if that is the direction that they really feel they need to go. Intensity of selection. And this is one my students don't always understand, but think about it this way, and just in terms of the ones that you've chosen for whatever reason, the bulls you've bought semen on, the bulls that you've bought, and I think about bulls. Don't worry about cows because you're not making any difference there, even if you think you are probably. But focus on the bulls. How much better are they than what you could have had? Just smack somebody else off my list that sold a high-dollar cow. How much better are the ones you got than the average? Did you get the best you could have got? Did you go as far as you could go? And you have to frame that in the context of both how much better for all traits and all how much better in one trait. Because we know about antagonisms and we know that there is more than one trait that's important. The last thing I want you to come away from in this talk is thinking that it's all about marbling and it's all about quality grade and the cow doesn't matter, because that would break my heart if you thought that. But the more things we have on our plate and the more mixed our messages are and some of those sort of things, it does challenge how much progress we can make. And some of the limitations in what we're changing in marbling is because that we have other things to worry about, quite honestly. And so that has to be, you know, couched in terms of the priority. But it's really a function of breeder's decisions. How do you make decisions? What does your breed decide and what do you emphasize? And one of the challenges, again, in terms of carcass quality is that even though we've come a long way, Dr. Green's paper talked about this exciting new thing called grid marketing and how, you know, how that was going to actually convey value all the way back to the seed stock operator and certainly back to the commercial cow operator, and what a wonderful thing that would be. And with retained ownership and grid marketing, that has done that to some extent, but still a relatively small proportion. You know, this is a very select group here, and you talked about how many commercial cow-calf operations retain ownership in this group, but you are not typical. You know that. This is the choir that I'm preaching to. And for the most part, the majority of the cow-calf industry does not retain ownership. Our industry is still challenged by assigning value to feeder cattle. And I think we'll continue to be for some time. I think there's some inroads happening there. But until we have a better way to assign value to superior feeder cattle, there will always be a challenge in terms of getting the money back where it belongs. And, of course, population size plays a role. The bigger population you're playing in, the more extreme the outliers. That's one of the real benefits that Angus has had, among others, is they work in a very large population. And so the best is best by a larger amount than in some of the other breeds. But I think the two that matter the most are these two. And these are the two that you guys can work on. And these are the two that we work on. A lot of the crazy things that you guys do to your cows that your town neighbors just don't understand. Things like squirting some oil on the back and then putting that thing that ought to be in a doctor's office on their back. It's about this. About pulling some hairs out of their tail or blood out of their tail or poking a hole in their ear or something like that. It's all about this. This is what we're going after. And you can easily have one without the other. You can shorten generation intervals as much as you want if you don't care what you get. And you can have all the accuracy if you've got, you know, years and years and years to work on it. But this is the challenge. It's always been the challenge in animal breeding. It will continue to be the challenge. But in some cases, I think we're giving up some things in terms of what we're getting done here. Are we losing some accuracy in some cases? Sometimes we're making wrong selection decisions, quite honestly. We are sometimes, in some segments, selecting on, for example, actual scan data or even scan ratios when we ought to be using the EPDs, that we are overemphasizing the individual measurement, underestimating the pedigree, the contemporary group relationships, and those sort of things. And when we do that, we make bad decisions. And we are not as accurate in picking the best animal as we certainly could. Are there limits in terms of IMF prediction? There's another group that I'm going to add to my list. But I think that in my lifetime, I think one of the miracles of science, I really think one of the miracles of science that I've seen is predicting marbling with ultrasound. I think that is lightning in a bottle. I can't imagine, I never would have dreamed that was possible. And we've shown that it is. But we know it's not perfect. It's better than anything else we can do, but it's not totally perfect. Anybody that studied stats knows that any prediction equation is best toward the center of the population. And the further we go out from the tails and trying to find outliers, the more difficult it becomes. Yet we are all about outliers. That is where it's at. That is what we're trying to do. That's how you make change. And so there is somewhat of a challenge there. We want the outliers, but those are the ones the systems probably evaluate the poorest. The EPD calculations help that because they sort of bring things back to the center. They consider the other information, but this is where I think we sometimes get into problems, that one of the reasons we focus so much on the actual scan data as opposed to the EPD is because the actual data is more extreme. And if you're marketing, you want to market an extreme. You want to have the big spread, the big number, the one that's most different. EPDs will bring it back to the center a little bit because they'll scale it by heritability. And so I think sometimes a more effective marketing tool in the short term seems to be the actual value because it just has more pizzazz to it. But I think it's hurting us a little bit. The other thing is I view ultrasound, and I'm not an ultrasound expert by any stretch of the imagination, but if someone that's kind of just watched as an observer, it concerns me a little bit. Ronnie Green talked a little bit about the limited number of relatively young people getting excited about quantitative genetics and some of those sort of things. But it really concerns me about our ultrasound technology in terms of the amount of development and research that's actually going on anymore. Is that done? I don't know. But the pioneers of this organization, of this part of our organization and this part of our industry, are not very active anymore, if they are active at all. And there's not a new generation of people picking this up and saying, let's take it to the next step. And I think there is a next level to achieve an ultrasound. It concerns me a little bit that there's not more model development and technology development occurring. And I hope that somewhere someone becomes inspired to take the work of the Breath Hours and the Wilsons and some of those and take it to the next step. Okay, here's another challenge for my friends that are in the EPD production business. I want to make their life a lot more difficult. And also the breed association people and also the AI studs. But Ken Anderson talked yesterday about the idea that we've sort of always held as one of the truths of the business is that EPDs happen twice a year. And when we're trying to shorten generation interval and get accuracy as quickly as we can, that's not necessarily optimum. Would it be possible, think about how much time passes between when you scan your yearlings and when you put semen in cows. Is there enough time to get some data in with electronic submission, get the EPDs calculated, not just interims, but real bluff EPDs? Because interims do help. They give you a good snapshot on those yearlings, but they don't tell you anything about their sires. And we want to figure out who are the most promising young sires. Can we give up another year, or can we shove it together, get it done? Maybe we don't need every trait analyzed, although birth weight would be nice to get analyzed there too, or calving ease rather. But it gives us an opportunity. Could we cut a year off by changing the way we do our evaluation? That would give us potentially 1 year sooner. We would have some meaningful parent EPDs on three-year-old bulls as opposed to four-year-old bulls as our first opportunity. Again, you'll have to figure out the value proposition of that and whether it's worth the effort. I'm just saying maybe that's a possibility. The other thing that we've talked about a little bit at BIF, we talked about it some yesterday in terms of how do we present the genetic information. That I think it's pretty much a consensus that the optimum accuracy selection, and again, I think of my BIF history, and I think about Dorian Garrick and Bruce Golden talking about economically relevant traits, and Mark Enns has been a part of that too, and talking about years ago in an evening symposium, and I can't tell you the town for that one, the idea of selecting on the trait of interest versus selecting on the indicator trait, and the most optimum way to do that. And I think the agreement is clear that the prediction ought to be on the trait of economic merit, the one that really makes folks money. The indicator trait is very important as a predictor of that, but that's not the end all. But yet in some segments of our industry, some breeds within, and several breeds actually, not just one, but three major breeds among our BIF membership still do it this way. And this is, again, also my perception is that when we do it that way, we actually discourage carcass data collection because in some ways we're saying it's not really important. Because the ultrasound number is what's getting used in marketing and some of that sort of thing, and they lessen the economic incentive to go to that trouble of carcass data collection. So again, conventional wisdom, as I perceive it, is that ultrasound measurements, at least some people would have this perception, that it's pretty much made collection of carcass of data. You pick your term. Is it irrelevant? Is it unimportant? Is it obsolete? Obviously, I agree with that sort of conventional wisdom, but I think at least that is out there in some cases. So here's my next audience response question for you. And I had to get at least one math question in before the day was over because I just love testing students on math. And this is a complicated one, so I'll kind of walk it through you kind of slow. Okay. Let's make an assumption, and I think this is a fairly valid assumption, a genetic correlation. You've heard people talk about genetic correlations. About 10 people in the room actually understand it, but you've heard a lot of us talk about it. But it's a relationship between traits and the genes that influence those. If we've got a 0.7 genetic correlation between traits, okay, and that's about what we typically find, sometimes a little better, sometimes a little worse, between an ultrasound measurement and a carcass measurement. We've got a bull that's got a 0.9 accuracy for an ultrasound EPD. Okay, that gives us about the same accuracy as going to a bull with a carcass EPD on the carcass scale of 0.9, 0.7, 0.63, and 0.28. Of course, I didn't give you a none of the above or I don't know. I just don't believe in giving you that option. I think you've got to guess. I think you've got to stick it out there. I'm anxious to see. Okay. Well, if I'd have been here, if I had probably not written this talk, that's probably what I'd have answered too. My students at K-State would call this a trick question. Okay. You know why? It's, you know what a trick question is in today's college environment? It's the one that a lot of students get wrong. Okay. So let's talk about that a little bit. My calculations say that the correct answer is 0.28. And there's a lot of head scratching, so let me go through. I know people love mathematical proofs, so I'll take a stab at that. It has to do with the way we describe accuracy. 20 years ago, some of our pioneers and people I have great respect for had a little different idea than other parts of the world about how we describe accuracy. And they were concerned that we were going to put too much emphasis on unproven animals, and so we scale accuracy in sort of an unusual way. And what that does is make sure we use the whole scale. And so we use all the numbers. If we use the true accuracy, the true correlation between our prediction and what you're really going to get, there wouldn't be accuracies below 0.4 or 0.5. But we spread it out, and I think for good reason. But that impacts the way we think about carcass and ultrasound a little bit. Say that bull has that BIF accuracy of 0.9. Okay? That means the true accuracy of selection, the way the Australians would describe accuracy, the way the dairy industry would describe accuracy, the probability in some ways of you making a good decision is really high. It's actually higher than you think. It's actually 0.995 if you do the mathematical transformation. I'll save you the pain of going through that. We said the genetic correlation is 0.7. And so indirect selection says we take the accuracy of selection on the indicator trait times the genetic correlation, and that gives you that 0.7 that a lot of you answer. And we've sort of set you up and said that's sort of the limit. But that's on the true accuracy scale. If you transpose that back to the EPD accuracy scale that you all know and love, that's actually 0.28. Okay? In other words, if you had a bull with a carcass accuracy, with carcass data only, of 0.28, you would expect to be as accurate in that selection as you would with ultrasound accuracy of 0.9 in the scale that you use. Okay? I think I got everybody on that one. Everybody. Certainly my ultrasound friends and some others. But let me couch that a little bit. Okay, now that I think I did maybe get some attention, it got awfully quiet. What I'm saying is that in a correlated approach, that adding a few carcass progeny has a pretty big weight. And I think the breeds that put carcass and ultrasound together see that. They've seen bulls that had a lot of ultrasound data come in, and they have a relatively low accuracy still on the carcass scale. And as we take that to we add some carcass data, that they do change somewhat. 0.7 is good, don't get me wrong. And quite honestly, 0.3 BIF accuracy is pretty good. We've always sort of got this in your head that a 0.2 or a 0.3 accuracy, you ever go to a bull sale and somebody says those EPDs are so low in accuracy they're not worth the paper they're printed on? That really burns me. I don't know about you guys, but it really burns me. Because it's not true. A 0.3 BIF accuracy is actually a pretty decent selection tool. It's an awfully good selection tool. Okay. It's just not the same as a 0.9 BIF accuracy. Okay. But there is change that is possible, and that an ultrasound-only IMF EPD, I think, overstates the accuracy somewhat in the terms of the change that we're really making. Now, so where does ultrasound fit in my estimation? If you come away thinking we're scanning too much, that is wrong. I think, if anything, we need to scan more. It's a powerful tool for identifying the next generation of young animals, and it's a powerful tool for commercial producers to make selection on bulls they're going to use in natural service. But I think that if we're going to say this is an AI sire that everybody needs to use, before we say that, I would like to see some carcass data collected. And I think that there's an opportunity to do that, particularly as you think about how our industry is changing in terms of electronic ID, in terms of instrument grading, in terms of source verified programs, many of which are sponsored by your breed associations. Is that not a great opportunity to collect more carcass data? There are bulls back in the carcass age that were discovered in commercial herds and made their way back to seed stock use because that commercial producer collected carcass data, but I don't see that happening very much anymore. And so that's a challenge that I present to the industry, is maybe to think about carcass a little more. So as conventional wisdom may say that carcass data is a done deal, my challenge is that maybe we shouldn't give up on it, that it's still an important factor of the things that I think we should consider. The next conventional wisdom, and this is something that also got some discussion yesterday afternoon, is that everybody knows we don't know the age of fed cattle. We always market them based on their fat or their weight. So why in the world do we adjust carcass data to an age constant endpoint? But as I think about it, really the endpoint of when we make a marketing decision and the way we adjust our data for comparisons are really two separate issues. That what, when we're making adjustments, we're trying to make fair comparisons among sires. If we've got three AI sires in a carcass contemporary group and then a cleanup bull, and those cleanup bull calves are 3 weeks or a month younger, we want to make that fair. Okay? We're not trying to project a lot about relative importance of traits or the ratio of traits or those sort of things. We're just trying to describe the animals in the best way that we can. There are plenty of ways, if you want to look at muscle relative to weight, to come up with equations, indexes, decision support, those sort of things. And Janice Rump's done an excellent job of digging in this issue, and I admire her work that she's put into on this at Montana State and with the Simmental data and the folks that have supported her. But she has a paper in the journal Animal Science. She had a presentation yesterday that showed that age is an appropriate endpoint. To make true genetic descriptions of animals, I think age is the right endpoint. And then if you want to go to muscling relative to weight or some of those sort of things, you can do that if that's really what makes you money. But again, I think that adjusting carcass data to constant age still makes sense in terms of characterizing the animals, in terms of describing their growth, describing how they, their progeny will partition and create tissue over time, and then we can always go to whatever function of cutability or whatever measure that we want to use with the next step. This is my favorite, that I think there are two sets of conventional wisdom in terms of genomic tools, but I think they're finally coming together a little bit. But a few years ago, I think you were in one camp or the other. It's either going to be the magic bullet that solves all our problems or that's the biggest wreck we've ever seen. Okay? And if you thought Georgia and Colorado State didn't used to get along, that sometimes these folks didn't get along very well either. One of the things that surprised me in the audience result the other day was how comfortable some of you said you were with these tools. Quite honestly, you're more comfortable with them than I was. And I don't know if you guys are really just that good, which you probably are, or maybe you're just, you know, a little naive. Maybe one of those is probably right. I think, though, that there are still some breeders that still see EPDs and genomic tools as sort of the enemy, and that they're sort of an either-or proposition and not something we can use together. I also think that most of us would agree that the real power of this is to identify, like ultrasound, that next generation of young animals, the most promising young ones that we can feed into a progeny test and ultimately become the ones we all get excited about. So why is there so much interest in marbling marker results, a trait that we can measure a number of different ways, on older proven AI sires that we've pretty much characterized their genetics as much as we ever will? But at the same time, I do feel better about this than I used to. There's no doubt the tools are getting better. They're coming along. The power is increasing as expected, and the rate of increase is not a flat. It is exponential. And I don't know if you guys were scared by Dr. Green's talk the other day, but I am excited. And I think that is going to continue to move in that direction. I'm more of a believer in this than I probably have ever been. And, of course, coming from the quantitative background, I'm naturally a skeptic. I also like the idea that we're coming to some agreement on the format in which these are reported, and I think we are moving into the format of getting these into some sort of EPD, and I think all those things will add to accuracy selection, make these much more user-friendly, and be a powerful tool. So while conventional wisdom may be kind of scattered, I'll just give you my perspective. I'm going to leave feeling better about this than I have in a long time. The last conventional wisdom I'll give for you is this, that as you think about time, and we're all fighting time to some extent, whether in our lives or in our business, but that it takes about 5 years for a generation. We're not breeding rats, we're breeding cattle. And that is a challenge. It's almost as bad as breeding horses. Well, no, it's not that bad, but it's bad. But it's about 5 years from generation to generation. I know you can turn it in two, but that's not average. It's 5 to 6. And then once you seed stock breeders make your selections, you've got to get it into the hands of the commercial people. And then it's going to be 5 or 6 years there. And so it's really shouldn't expect a whole lot of change in a decade. And my further review is really that's pretty much spot on. So I think that while there are some challenges that we have and some things that we can do better, that patience is a scarce commodity in this room, and that's why we're here, is because we've been impatient, and God, that impatience has driven us here. But we really do have to have some patience and couch the expectations that we have that it is coming, and I think there will change will occur if we kind of stay the course and maybe innovate in a few different and new ways. So with that, Mark, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you, and maybe perhaps to take some questions either formally or informally a little later.